You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. In the next hour, we'll get the latest on the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist.
There's only one country in the world that still publicly calls for the destruction of another country, not of Israel, of any country, and this is Iran that publicly calls for the destruction of Israel.
We'll be talking to the man who keeps an eye on space to make sure that no asteroid or comet is heading towards planet Earth. We'll also find out what our culture editor gets up to when he's not safely behind his desk here at Midori House. And it must be the second week in January because someone's invented a chocolate that makes you thinner. All that plus some great music here on Midori House, live from Studio One in London. All that's come in the next 60 minutes. First of all, though, let's get the latest news from around the world with Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Emma. Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says the country's nuclear path will not change after an Iranian nuclear scientist was killed today. The scientist was killed in a car bomb. Tehran accuses Israel of the killing, saying it's evidence of foreign government-sponsored terrorism. Meanwhile, Russia's deputy foreign minister says his country opposes US and possible European oil sanctions against Iran, even if Tehran presses ahead with uranium enrichment, which Western powers say serves military goals. Sergei Ryabkov said new sanctions against Iran would not strengthen nuclear non-proliferation. In Britain, David Cameron and Labour leader Ed Miliband have jointly urged the Scottish people to reject calls for independence if a referendum is held on the subject. The Prime Minister told MPs he believed passionately in the union, while Mr Miliband said its breakup would damage the UK's economy. Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond says he aims to hold a vote in 2014. In the House of Commons, Scottish National Party MP Angus Robertson said the Conservatives are so weak in Scotland they shouldn't be trying to influence Scottish opinion.
The Conservative Party has less members of Parliament than there are giant pandas in Edinburgh Zoo. Why is the Prime Minister trying to emulate Margaret Thatcher by dictating to Scotland?
The French journalist was among eight people killed in an explosion in the Syrian city of Homs today, becoming the first Western reporter to have died in 10 months of unrest in the country. A Dutch journalist was among 25 other people injured. In a written statement, France Télévision said they'd learned the death of reporter Gilles Jacquier with a great deal of sorrow, but they did not have any details of the circumstances of his death. The channel said Jacquier, who'd previously reported from Iraq and Afghanistan, had been invited to Syria by the government. Two Swedish journalists sentenced to 11 years in jail in Ethiopia for illegally entering the country and aiding a rebel group have decided to seek clemency rather than lodge an appeal. Reporter Martin Shibi and photographer Johan Persson were arrested in July after they entered the country from Somalia with an outlawed group of rebel fighters. Legal experts say certain conditions have to be fulfilled before a pardon is considered. Wondwasen Demisi, assistant law professor at Addis Ababa University, says it all depends on how the authorities view terrorism.
If it is considered as a crime against humanity, then they may not be eligible for pardon, because under Ethiopian law, a crime against humanity, as I said earlier, including genocide, torture and so on, are not pardonable.
More than 10% of parents around the world say their child has been cyberbullied. Nearly a quarter know a youngster who's been a victim. The online Ipsos poll questioned more than 18,000 adults in 24 countries, 6,500 of whom were parents. 60% said social networking sites like Facebook are the most frequent places for cyberbullying. Mobile devices and online chat rooms were a distant second and third. The price of orange juice has hit a record high on global markets, continuing the big rises of the past few days. There's been a 25% increase in price since the beginning of the year. Traders say the main reasons are safety concerns about juice from Brazil and cold weather in Florida. The US Food and Drug Administration says a fungicide has been found in shipments from Brazil, the world's largest producer. Those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Barney, thanks very much indeed. Time now to take a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather
in association with Kuoni Travel.
Well, in Europe, a cold snap is on the way, not a severe one, and it'll mainly affect Scandinavia, Central and Eastern Europe. By the weekend, we're talking about temperatures in many European cities just around freezing. That's about a 5 to 7 degree drop compared to the current temperatures. Some snow is expected too from Sweden and around the Baltic. However, in the west of Europe, in the UK and France, we'll escape most of the cold with some sunshine. Here's Thursday's city outlook. In London, still mild, 11 degrees, partly cloudy. Berlin, 8 Celsius and rain. Stockholm, 3 degrees with rain and snow. In Lisbon, 13 Celsius and sunny. Over to North America now. Rainy weather is engulfing the eastern half of the United States. Wet weather heading for the Big Apple for Thursday. Windy conditions too. And we're also going to see snow in Chicago, also New England, and over in Ontario and Quebec. So keep a close eye on the flights in and out of Chicago O'Hare, and the Canadian airports could be some delays. Here's Thursday's city outlook. In Ottawa, -2 degrees with snow. Chicago, -3 and snow, and temperatures falling as low as -13 at night. In New York City, +5 and rain. In Miami, 27 with just a few showers. And a final look at other world destinations. Buenos Aires has been quite humid and thundery in the last couple of days. The next few days will be sunny and fresher with a modest high of 24 degrees. In Rio, a chance of showers right through the weekend, but hot here, 31 Celsius. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
It's just coming up to 7 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 highlights, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, ei ole koko.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala version.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And our top story on today's Midori House is the assassination of an Iranian nuclear scientist in a car bomb in Tehran. Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan was killed when a motorcyclist stuck an explosive in his car. Well, several scientists have died in the last few months, with the Iranians placing the blame on the United States or the Israelis. To assess the impact of today's assassination, I spoke to the Israeli investigative journalist, Dr. Ronan Bergman. He's author of a book called The Secret War with Iran and also an expert on Mossad. I began by asking him if this was a continuation of an attempt to derail Iran's nuclear program.
With no doubt, in the last 4 to 5 years, anonymous agency or entity launched a campaign in order to secretly sabotage the Iranian nuclear project with the use of mysterious mishaps, explosions, bombings, and assassinations. Of course, we don't know who did the bombing, the assassination today, and the last bombings in a few Iranian sites. But we can say that it was for many years the policy of the Israeli Mossad, the Foreign Intelligence Service of Israel, to try to assassinate adversaries, scientists, proliferators, nuclear proliferators, in order to achieve two main goals. One of them, to take out significant figures inside the Iranian or other nuclear projects, people that have a lot of gravity, profound importance to the continuation of the project, mainly scientists. And the other target, which might be not less important than the first one, would be to spread fear, intimidation among the scientists who are left behind, that they might end up like their friends.
Iran's Vice President Mohammad Reza Rahimi has said today that it is government-sponsored terrorism behind this attack. What would you say to that?
I would say that Iran, and I'm not an Israeli government spokesman, and I have a lot of criticism towards Israel, but I would say this. There's only one country in the world that still publicly calls for the destruction of another country, not just of Israel, of any country, and this is Iran, that publicly calls for the destruction of Israel, that publicly, overtly, admits helping a jihadist movement in the Middle East to send suicide bombers to buses, killing women and children in Israel, that is trying, and this is according to a worldwide consensus, is trying to obtain nuclear capability. If I would be in charge of the Israeli intelligence services, if I would be an Israeli leader, I would be I will do everything I can to stop this country who calls for the destruction of my country from obtaining the means to deliver such annihilation.
So how effective is an assassination like this? It's been called in the past a so-called decapitation strategy, whereby you take out the key brains behind the nuclear program in order to not only, as you say, scare the other scientists, but actually to really put the brakes on Iran's program.
I'm quite sure, I'm quite positive that nobody expects such a huge project with the participation of dozens or hundreds of technicians and scientists to be stopped only by the elimination of few individuals. Iran is a highly advanced technological country, and I think that they would be able to continue with the project even with the lacking of few individuals. However, this is part of an overall effort to boycott Iran, to sanction Iran's economy, to try and stop the dual-use export, dual-use equipment export to Iran and others. And the hope is that all these together, all these efforts combined, might convince the Iranian leadership that there is a significant price tag not to the existence of this project, but to the continuation, meaning that they risk the stability of their own regime if they continue with the project.
And how much do you think that the Iranians will be put off by this? Because this entire week has been dominated by a sort of an exchange of symbolic gestures by Iran and people against Iran. For example, the embargo on oil exports was then followed immediately by Iran saying, OK, well, we now have developed, we're enriching uranium in Qom, and then now we have this back. I mean, at what stage will Iran start to retaliate at a slightly more serious level?
I would think that there's a strong chance that the Iranian, I would say, so far moderate reaction to this series of sabotages and assassination that they attribute to the Israeli Mossad, that the moderate approach will not continue, and we might be seeing responses from Iran, such as attacking Jewish or Israeli targets outside of Israel. The rhetoric used by Iran is also something everyone should expect, and everybody are using words in order to try to intimidate and to frighten the other side. I'm not sure that that sort of rigid approach reflects the mindset of everybody working inside the Iranian nuclear project. Bear in mind, they are people, they are scientists, not trained fighters. They have families. The families are pressuring them to leave the project, to quit their job because of the fear that they might end up like their colleagues. So rhetoric aside, I think that these assassinations do have an impact, a profound impact, on the spirit, on the mindset of what is happening inside the project.
And that was Dr. Ronan Bergman, author of The Secret War with Iran, and also an expert of Mossad, talking to me earlier about the impact of today's assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan. Time now, Midori House, for some music. This is Mnemonics, and You Lied. And that was Mnemonics and You Lied on Midori House. In a moment, we'll be catching up with our culture editor, so stay with us.
Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24, and also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
every day this week on Midori House, we've been coaxing our editors into the studio to get an idea of the latest news in their field of expertise. Today, it is the turn of our culture editor, Robert Bound. He talked to me earlier in the studio to tell me what he's got up to when he's been allowed out of the building and let loose on the streets of London for a week.
Actually, I've been rather selfish this week because last week I took off.
Right.
I avoided the maelstrom of the first day back in the studio and went and saw all the things that I hadn't seen that I wished I had. And now I have, and I'm glad I did.
What did you
see? What do you think about
that? I think it's amazing.
Try writing that down.
I think you're trying to do all the things that we all say that we will do one day but never do.
Exactly.
Try writing that down.
Yes, so I've written my novel and I'm resigning.
Congratulations. Lovely to know you.
So I went off and took myself off to Pipilotti Wrist and George Condo at the Hayward Gallery.
Yep.
And I think that closes sort of, I think, this weekend.
Tell us about it.
Pipilotti Wrist is a Swiss artist in her 30s. It's sort of female body art. It's a bit like Tracy Emin if she was a bit less scratchy and self-conscious.
Okay.
I think Tracy Emin's got a great sense of humour.
Yeah.
But sometimes her art doesn't maybe have the same sense of humour.
She's quite
she
brittle.
Has. Yeah. Pipilotti Wrist is a robust, a slightly more robust person. And so it's installation work and it's video work. And it's a sort of exhibition that slightly self-consciously, but in a really fun way, makes you have to sort of lie down and look at certain things or creep through weird little spaces to look at things. So it's about, it sort of plays with the notion of how the gallery works as much as what an artwork is and what a video installation is.
When
piece
the building becomes a space.
A bit,
play
yeah.
With.
Yeah, so it's cool. So there's various different sort of, you move through a lot of different spaces and textures and sounds and senses
right.
To look at that. So that's
a great
show.
What was the overall impression you got of it when you came out of it?
I was shit scared. No, I thought it was amazing. The last thing, if you go around the exhibition in sort of nominally the correct order, the last piece, you go, she eats you and then excretes you. That's at the end of the show.
It's a little rude, isn't it?
There you are. Well, you've had the complete human experience.
You've given her the time and your energy, and then she does that to you.
I know, exactly.
I'd consider that to be quite a rude gesture.
I was fairly clean when I came out the other end. It was fine. I felt.
Did you feel suitably digested?
I felt empowered and impured or purified. And then upstairs is George Condo at the Hayward Gallery.
Right,
it's a sort
of
dual exhibition.
So you've dealt with Pippi's long downstairs.
Let's do that. We've done that. Let's not
when we've done
do
our downstairs, we'll
words.
Go upstairs.
Yeah. So George Condo's upstairs. He's a New York artist. He kind of prefigured people like John Curran and people that became kind of quite trendy in the late 90s and early noughties. And he's technically an amazing painter. This is a portrait thing that he's doing, by the way.
Yeah.
There are some bronze busts. And he's very famous for his portraits of our queen and sort of messing around with the idea, making some of them cartoony, some of them like a Terminator, something like this, that and the other. So he's always he's riffing on iconography and he does also a triptych of Christ on the cross. And so he's messing around with the sort of ideas of iconography. Some of them look like bacon, some of them look like Mickey Mouse. So it's kind of pop art and really skillful portraiture. So he's a man with a great sense of humour. Sometimes I wonder how much his heart is in it and how much it's just it's very witty, but I wonder sometimes where his heart and soul is, poor George Condo.
So
but go and see it, because it's still worth
say,
talking
so worth
about
going
and seeing. And there's upstairs at the Hayward.
That's upstairs at the Hayward.
Yeah.
So if you're not at the Hayward, where else do you go?
If you're not at the Hayward, if you're not at the Hayward, go down to the Tate before it closes, Tate Modern, and go and see Gerhard Richter.
Right.
It's an amazing retrospective of one of the greatest living artists, I'd have said. And that, again, is a mixture of all his sort of different bits and bobs, his sort of occluded paintings and huge canvases and installation pieces and all sorts of
and
stuff.
And if you've only got one morning, is it Hayward or Tate?
I think you should probably go to the Tate.
Okay.
And these are all sort of retrospective exhibitions. It's kind of a nice, it's sort of that one of those things where you can trot out on a crisp, fresh January morning and go and sort of see these things. And there's no one else there because everyone's gone back to the office, the fools. So what I'd recommend to everybody is to take a sick day and take a duvet day, as they call it,
in nauseating
companies in California.
Monocle 24 would ever endorse
we'd
anybody.
We'd never do anything like
to
that.
Bunk off work.
So that's your art.
That's your art. What else did you do?
And then the NFT, you've got a Woody Allen season on, which is amazing. It's one of those things, how often do you see kind of classics, you know, from the 70s and 80s on a big screen.
You always naturally assume it's playing somewhere, but you never can find
a classic
film when you want to see one.
Yeah,
so and then suddenly a whole season comes along.
And exactly, or maybe two, like buses, right?
Exactly.
And this is great. I went to see Hannah and her sisters.
Lovely.
And the whole, pretty much everything is on, from sort of Bananas to things like Zelig to things like Husbands and Wives,
it's which
are a bit
Woody
more
Allen.
Dark. It's all Woody. Well, not, that's not just what they're playing, but they have a big season. And there's lots of tickets. There's all sorts of, I think it runs on until the beginning of February. So that's
fantastic.
Super cool. And it's just great. It's nice to hear these lines that you've quoted so many times to people trying to suggest that this is the best film ever made. Maybe it's Annie Hall. That's on Saturday. It's nice to see them on a screen bigger than your TV at home.
And is it still good? Because you always think you enjoyed them and you always remember.
I like that question.
Them.
Is it still good?
Is it still good?
Does it still work for you, Rob?
Does it still?
Do you like that?
Did it?
Aren't they? Isn't it? It's still great. It's even better because it's as it was meant to be seen, you know? Yeah. It's like, it's one of those weird things. Watching a DVD of a film, sometimes it's a bit like reading a play rather than seeing it because it's so weirdly sometimes small depending upon what you see it on.
You also have the physical distraction of not being in the cinema, which commands your attention, which a lot of us really underestimate.
And I did go to a slightly, as is always the case in the rickety London theatres, sat in a far less comfortable chair than one of the nice seats at the NFT.
Right.
I went and saw Noises Off at the Old Vic, which is Michael Frayn's sort of Faster Than a Fast, Play Within a Play, deconstruction of how theatre works.
So you basically did a whole week last week of looking at retrospectives, and you actually did retrospective theatre and retrospective film as well.
Yeah, yeah, I don't like to see anything new.
No.
Welcome to the golden hour here on Capital Gold.
All the things you must see in London, all at least 30 years old.
Yeah, totally. As you enter a new year, you have to take stock of the last 40.
You also feel, I don't know about you, but do you ever feel as if you have to get your classics under your belt?
You do. You have to embrace the canon.
Yes,
don't you, before
yes.
you can start reading the new stuff.
So Noises Off apparently has got brilliant reviews and has had direct comparisons with the other great farce that's just about to transfer to, I think it's going to Broadway, One Man, Two Brothers. Which I've seen and made me laugh for half an hour. Mm. It was just amazing. And then someone said, actually,
that's a shame because it's 2 hours long.
There was one particular scene.
A quarter of it is funny.
The quarter of it I can remember because I was laughing so much. But then everybody said, actually, Noises Off is where you really need to be going to really deconstruct a bit of farce and enjoy it. Is it still any good?
Well, I didn't see it in its first incarnation, but it's supremely funny. And I suppose it's that amazing thing of, I suppose, being able to look back at it with, you know, and realising that it was sort of of its time, but then what's it taking the piss out of Molière, I suppose, or something like that, you know? So it's a three-act play that's done. First of all, you see the farce, then the stage is turned around and you see the actors against the sort of wooden back of the stage being pushed on and fighting and brawling and having affairs and getting drunk behind the stage. And then the third act is them doing the farce but incredibly badly after all this stuff has happened. And it sort of shows you that in order to be funny, there are tight constraints on drama and structure and just on social stuff. You have to get on with each other.
It always used to be the play that you would have at university, that every single university theatre company would always do Noises Off. And it's actually quite nice to see it in, how do I say it, not the grown-ups doing it, but in a professional arena.
The grown-ups. They've mostly grown up. Yeah, exactly. I think it's a good, I was sitting there watching it. It's so amazingly, brilliantly written by Michael Frayn, who is the first play of his I'd seen. I love his novels, but I haven't seen it. This is the first play of his I'd seen. So the writing is just incredibly tight and hilarious. But it's definitely a play for actors who are not just actors who are show-offs, but show-offs who are actors as well. It's a showy piece, you know. So there's a lot of amazing set pieces in it.
And very briefly, if you had 2 hours in London in which to do one of those amazing things that you've just told us about, what would it be?
Go and see Noises Off, I think. Go and see Noises Off and then go to the Tate and get the Book of Richter. Right? Because if you literally can't do it in that time, if you're being that tight with time, Emma Nelson. All right.
We are tight with time, so I'm afraid we're going to have to finish our little conversation.
Do we want this?
Yes, please.
All right.
Could you tell everybody what this is?
I don't know. This isn't really the record of the week. It was good. It was a good prompt. I don't think anyone knew what I was doing there when I was waving a record sleeve in your face.
Do you want this?
Do you want this? Do you want some
cake? Yes, please. I'd love it.
Do you want it? This is Cake, a band who've been going for a few years. They're one of those American bands that sort of trot out an album. They're not work shy, but they're kind of considered. They've got a considered working practice.
Right.
I think it's their first record for 7 or 8 years, and it's called Showroom of Compassion. They're sort of gruff. They're quite ironic. You might file them in the same niche as Lamb Chop, somewhere between Lamb Chop and Wilco. And I know everyone will know exactly what I mean.
I know
when
that.
I say that.
I understand.
And this track is the second track from the album, which came out on the 9th of January, which is a couple of days ago. And this is called Long Time.
Long time since I've seen your smiling face. It's been a long time since I've seen a sunny day. Expensive
French perfume. And that's Cake and Long Time. Our culture editor, Robert Bounds' choice of music following his ever-so-baroque take on what we should be doing in London this week. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be talking to someone who believes women still have to fight to get into the boardroom. But before that, here's the news with Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Emma. Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says the country's nuclear path will not change after an Iranian nuclear scientist was killed today. He died in a car bomb attack. Tehran accuses Israel of the killing, saying it's evidence of foreign government-sponsored terrorism. In Britain, David Cameron and Labour leader Ed Miliband have jointly urged the Scottish people to reject calls for independence if a referendum is held on the subject. The Prime Minister told MPs he believed passionately in the union, while Mr Miliband said its breakup would damage the UK's economy. A French journalist was among eight people killed in an explosion in the Syrian city of Homs today, becoming the first Western reporter to have died in 10 months of unrest in the country. Gilles Jacquier, who'd previously reported from Iraq and Afghanistan, had been invited to Syria by the government. Two Swedish journalists sentenced to 11 years in jail in Ethiopia for illegally entering the country and aiding a rebel group have decided to seek clemency rather than lodge an appeal. Martin Skibbe and Johan Persson were arrested in July after they entered the country from Somalia with an outlawed group of rebel fighters. More than 10% of parents around the world say their child has been cyberbullied, and nearly a quarter know a youngster who's been a victim. The online Ipsos poll questioned more than 18,000 adults in 24 countries, 6,500 of whom were parents. 60% said social networking sites like Facebook are the most frequent places for cyberbullying. And the price of orange juice has hit a record high on global markets after going up by 25% since the beginning of the year. Traders say the main reasons are safety concerns about juice from Brazil and cold weather in Florida.
Thanks very much indeed, Barney. 28 minutes to the top of the hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. In a little while, we'll be talking to the man whose job it is to scour our skies for wayward comets or asteroids, which might be on the way to blow us to kingdom come. But before that, some music. And this is Funk Community. Pass it on. That was Funk Community on Monocle 24 and Pass It On. We head now to the boardroom because the number of women directors in British boardrooms has now reached its highest ever level. And a new report shows that women are better in a recession because they're more risk averse. So to tell us more on the phone, we have Lauder, the founder Centre for the Inclusive Leadership and author of The Female Leadership Paradox, Mirella Visser. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Mirella. Explain to us, it's quite exasperating, some would say, that in 2012, we're still talking numbers in boardrooms.
Yes, I think it's really something that we need to continue doing, because as long as there's still only almost 15% women on those boards, there's still a lot of work to do. So I think we need to continue with the debate.
Why is 15% considered to be... is it good enough? I mean, why do people say this is a remarkable achievement?
Well, actually, it is remarkable because it's the first time ever in history that the number is so high. So in that way, it is remarkable. But if you would look at, for instance, Lord Davies' report last year that came out, his target was actually 25%. So we haven't reached that target yet. You know, 15% is quite interesting if you compare it to last year when it was more than 12%. But it's nowhere near 25%, which was actually what a lot of company leaders were promising Lord Davies to do. So we still have a long way to go.
And when you talk about quotas such as 15, 25%, 12%, how constructive a level do you think, a gauge do you think that is? Or should we stop thinking about proportions of representatives in boardrooms? Or should we just hire who's good at the job?
Of course, you know, we should always hire the best person for the job. But the issue is with women on boards that there is a lot of women very qualified out there that simply do not get hired. because of multiple reasons. And one of the instruments to actually make that more clear is to, you know, start talking about it, start measuring it, you know, like all these monitors, you know, it's very interesting to see all these data, and then also to start putting real action to it. And I'm very happy that in the UK, especially a number of CEOs have said, well, this has to change, and we're now going to make that change through that Lord Davies report and also through the individual actions. That's something that needs to be done, I think.
You said just there about the fault lies in when they actually start hiring people.
Yes.
So you're saying that the change still needs to be from absolutely at the outset at the recruitment process?
I think the recruitment process is certainly a process that needs to be improved in many ways. What you've seen traditionally is that the male boards would select their successors also to be male, simply because it's easier to work with, you know each other, and also because often women that are very qualified for these board positions are simply not visible. There's also a reluctance from women to actually make themselves known and to make themselves visible to be eligible for board positions. So it's two ways. Both genders need to become more aware of the fact that, you know, there is a lot of more value in a mixed team than in an all-male or all-female team.
It's interesting that you place the blame equally with women than of men. What is stopping women from doing this?
Yes. Well, I think historically, women haven't been talking about being eligible for boards. When I started my career, which is about 25 years ago, I noticed that the men across, you know, in the universities, they were already talking about their careers and about their 25-year plan, and many of them have reached those board positions, whereas we as women were simply not immediately looking at that. So I think it is something that needs to become more, women need to become more aware of the fact that that's also a career option for them. That simply needs time. And we see that that's changing now, fortunately, because the younger generations are far more quick to actually pick that up and also to start striving for those board positions. Because if you say, I want to have a board position in 25 years' time, you need to make choices before then, because you need to have a profile that is board ready, so to speak. So what I always advise women is to, if you're ambitious enough to want to become a board member, don't get, for instance, stuck in supporting roles and traditional female roles, like in the HR or in other supporting functions, because typically they don't lead to board positions. So you need to become more conscious of your career choices. And that is simply something that women are starting to do now in the last generation.
So finally, one last question. We mentioned at the top of this item that the number of women directors in British boardrooms is at a high level. Very, very briefly, could you tell us who's good and who's not so good globally?
Globally? Well, if you look at the European level, so the European 27 countries, we are now at about 12%. So that is relatively, you know, a little bit less than you are in the UK. But then, for instance, if you look at Japan, the numbers are not even above 1%. So that's very low. If you look at, for instance, the US, we're around 14 to 15%. So it's also not very much higher. There is not a country in the world where the numbers are as high as, for instance, in Norway. As you probably know, we have quota legislation in Norway, and there the numbers of women on boards have now reached the level of 40% and more. So within Europe, we have superb examples of countries that have done this in a different way and are very successful. But there's also countries like Italy where the numbers are also very much in the low numbers, like 2 or 3%. So there's a big difference across Europe.
Afraid we're going to have to leave it there. That's Mirella Visser. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. Every Saturday, Monocle's editors team up with a lively mix of guests to take a leisurely look back at the week past and pull out their personal highlights, cultural, political, musical, cinematic, and more. Our Saturday show is the perfect accompaniment to the weekend papers and a good coffee. The Review comes to you in association with J.Crew every Saturday at 11 a.m. London time, right here on Monocle 24, and is also available on our timeshift player on monocle.com and on iTunes.
And now on Midori House, a tale to make us rest easy in our beds. The United Kingdom has a Space Guard Centre. Its purpose is to keep a watchful eye on our skies and spot any wayward comet or os asteroids which might be on their way to blow us to smithereens. Well, to tell us more, I'm very pleased to say on the line we have Jay Tate, who's Director of Space Guard UK. A very warm welcome to you, Jay, to Midori House. So tell us on a day-to-day basis, your job, what exactly do you do for a living?
That's quite hard to say, really, because it's never quite the same, 2 days running. We tend to spend the days showing people around, telling people what we do, why we do it, and so on. And then, obviously, if it's clear, at nights, we're actually doing the work.
And your work, what does this involve? Not to be too flippant, do you have a perpetually sore neck from looking skyward?
Absolutely not. Nobody looks through big telescopes anymore. It's looking at a screen. We use cameras on the telescopes. We're just taking pictures, analysing the images, producing the data from the images, and then we can send that off to the United States, to the Minor Planet Centre, where they do the number crunching.
And what exactly are you looking for?
Well, at the moment, we're in the tracking business. We're tracking asteroids that are found elsewhere, mainly by the American surveys. Before you can calculate an orbit for an asteroid to find out where it's going, you need measurements. You've got to track it across the sky. And that's what we're doing at the moment. We're not into a search program looking for new asteroids yet. Because the telescopes that we're using aren't the right sort for that. But we have a telescope that's perfect for the job, and at the moment we're just building a dome to put it in.
You say there that you're not into the search for new asteroids, but I understand that you have an asteroid named after you, what used to be 2000 DZ12, is that right?
That's right, yes, which is rather nice. But you don't name an asteroid that you discover after yourself. That's definitely not...
That would be a little rude, wouldn't
that's it? That's not kosher at all.
No.
No. Asteroids are named by the discoverers for people who they feel, you know, deserve it. And it was an enormous privilege to have one named.
You must have been tickled pink by that, I must confess. Now, you're based in Wales, and obviously you're looking into the night sky, but we're assuming that it's not just the Welsh who you're protecting here, is it?
No. It's a global problem, and clearly there needs to be a global solution. But just at the moment, the only country really doing anything sensible is the United States. So all of our data gets sent to the United States.
When you say this is a global problem and global solution, let me throw a very loose scenario at you. A massive asteroid is heading towards planet Earth. Possibly, if anyone's seen Melancholia by Lars von Trier, there's an enormous asteroid coming to kill us all. What do you do next? Who do you ring?
Well, in the UK, I don't ring anybody. There's nobody to ring. There is no government department or civil servant or minister who's responsible for this issue at all. So I suppose I could choose whether it's, you know, the BBC or the Sun, really.
I must confess, if someone rang the newsroom and said there's a massive asteroid heading towards planet Earth, one might be tempted to take the announcement with a pinch of salt. Who do you talk to who will actually say, well, no, listen, let's do something about it? And then a very silly question, what actually can be done if an asteroid's heading towards us?
Well, to deal with the first bit first, as I said, in the UK, there is absolutely nobody to talk to. The system in the United States is much more grown up. They actually have a system all the way through from the telescope to the White House. There is a set procedure that goes all the way up the line. And in fact, that was proved very nicely back in 2008. As far as what can we actually do about an asteroid, well, that entirely depends on the amount of notice that we've got. The aim of the game that we're in is to get a good few decades of notice. And with that time, you've got plenty of opportunity to give the asteroid just a tiny little nudge to, in effect, turn a direct hit into a near miss.
How do you do that?
Well, that depends entirely on what the thing's made of, how it's put together, how fast it's spinning, and so on. You'd look a little bit foolish taking on a big fluffy snowball like a comet in the same way as a solid slab of metal. But the idea would simply be to literally deflect it. Now, you could do that either by hitting it with something. You could do it by using gravity. Park a spacecraft next to the asteroid or comet and gently edge the spacecraft away. You could do it by using a large inflatable mirror to concentrate sunlight onto one particular spot on the surface. That spot vaporizes. The vapor jets outwards, producing thrust in the opposite direction. There's any number of ways of doing it, but they all depend on having long period of notice. And that's what the current surveys and the work we do is trying to get.
How much notice do you on average get?
Well, that's very difficult to say because we've not been hit by a large one in, you know, the period that we've been observing. But for objects bigger than about 1 kilometer across, we should expect a good few decades of notice because those are the objects that the current surveys are trying to pick up. Smaller than that, we have a bit of an issue because the smaller ones are not currently being looked for in any systematic way. The Americans want to do it, but of course it's, as usual, a sort of funding issue. And they're also very keen that other countries should help, but no other countries have offered to help.
Jay, it sounds like obviously it's an incredibly expensive business, not only monitoring but also deflecting these things. I get the impression that you think that this whole business isn't taken seriously enough. Is that right?
Well, you say incredibly expensive. It depends on your scale of expense, if you like. For example, to set up the survey to find nearly all the asteroids bigger than 150 metres across over a space of about 10 years would cost about 1/20th of what we're spending on the 2012 Olympics. To mount a mission to deflect an asteroid would cost less than the normal planetary missions that we're sending out all the time at the moment because you don't have to have all the instruments and the cameras and the rest of it. So when it comes to expense, in grown-up terms, this is cheap and cheerful.
Jay, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Thank you for sparing us some of your time from looking skywards. That was Jay Tate, Director of Spaceguard UK.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 is your concern.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The
Propa Jalavet,
Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I met a Monocle 24.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
9 minutes before the top of the hour here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. Time for some music, Royksopp, and In Space.
Thank you.
And there was Røyksopp and In Space on Monocle 24. We go now to some interesting news from Denmark for those of us with a sweet tooth. A group of researchers claims to have invented chocolate that not only doesn't make you put on weight, but can actually make you slimmer. And apparently the tests to see if this really is true are running now. Down the line to talk to us about it, we have Professor Arne Astrup, who's head of the Department of Human Nutrition at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. Professor Astrup, a very warm welcome. Let me start off by asking you that what inspired you to try to make our waistlines a little slimmer?
Oh, that's a terrible story. I was actually invited by the owner of the famous Danish restaurant Noma, which is ranked as number one in the world. The owner, he invited me to a chocolate competition eating contest where we were supposed to eat as much dark chocolate as possible. And after 350 grams of dark chocolate, I had so much nausea that I couldn't eat more. And that wasn't enough for a second award. But the problem was that the rest of the day, I really had a terrible nausea and I couldn't eat anything. And I knew had it been milk chocolate I've been eating, it wouldn't have been a problem to eat 200 or 300 grams, really. So that I think that was the first idea that why is dark chocolate so fulling and satiating? And so we did a study where we compared dark chocolate to milk chocolate, and it really showed that people are feeling much more full and satiated after small amounts of dark chocolate than milk chocolate. And it seems to be due to the special fat that is in dark chocolate, namely stearic acid, which has a very high melting point. So it's just staying in the stomach for a very long time and giving you this sensation of filling up. And so we felt, why not try to do something more of this, give the chocolate some more properties that can help you to not to overconsume and gain weight.
This this chocolate that has obviously brought on an unusual feeling of satiation, what do you then add to it to make us all stop eating it?
Yeah, actually what we're doing is to add something that will, you know, even increase its satiety more. And that's a combination of some fiber and that will give you this additional satiety. But on top of that, we're also adding something that will increase your caloric burning, so you're burning off more some of the calories. And that's a combination of chili, capsaicin that is in chili, and together with a little caffeine and something from green tea that also works with together with caffeine and capsaicin from hot chili peppers, really to speed up your metabolism so you will burn off more of the calories that you ingest. And finally, we are also adding some fiber that binds some of the fat from the chocolate. So it means that you can eat it, but it will be bound, so it will simply pass through your gastrointestinal tract and come out with the stools. So we felt these three different targets to try to influence your calorie balance is really a clever way to try to make some more healthy dark chocolate.
And very briefly, do you think that you've made this chocolate? It sounds as if it's got the, you know, you're throwing the kitchen sink at it. Does it actually taste nice?
Pardon?
Does it taste good?
It has a very good taste, and I think that's the most surprising one, that we have made different versions of it. And it's actually very tasty. And it's because, you know, in Mexico and Korea, they actually add chili to the chocolate. It gives a very pleasant aftertaste. And the flaxseed fiber we use to give satiety and bind some of the fat has a slightly nutty taste that is also very pleasant. So in some way, it really seems to have all the good properties we really like.
Professor Astrup, I'm terribly sorry to cut you short. I could have listened to you a lot longer about whether this tastes very nice, but I'm afraid we've run out of time. That's Professor Arne Astrup, the head of the Department of Human Nutrition at the University of Copenhagen, at Eating Chocolate for the World's Good. I'm afraid we're out of time for this Wednesday's edition of Midori House. We were produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Annex Funnell. I'll be back in 3 hours with the Monocle Daily, but that's all from us on the Midori House. Thank you for listening.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.